Peter B. Collins News and Comments here on Tuesday, June 5th, 2012. Our lead story today, the Supreme Court's refusal, its denial, to take up the appeal of former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman, and he is headed back to federal prison. And I don't know if he'll be singing that song. The original was by the Bobby Fuller Four, and that's the version of I Fought the Law by The Clash. I had a chance to talk to Governor Siegelman earlier today, and while he is shy about doing interviews until his resentencing is final, I did share with him my sadness at these turn of events, and that the gross injustice piled one on another that makes up this travesty. And in today's in-depth interview, we discuss many of these details with Andrew Craig, an attorney and the executive director of the Justice Integrity Project. And what we see is a justice system that doesn't work, and in this case is going to deliver a punitive blow to a man who is in the same position as almost every elected official who has ever accepted a campaign contribution. And the persecution of Don Siegelman, as Andrew Craig points out, goes back all the way to 1999. I joined this sordid soap opera in progress around 2005. And I've had the opportunity to talk with Governor Siegelman, to Scott Horton of Harper's, the Columbia University law professor who has written about this. I want to credit Larissa Alexandrovna from rawstory.com, who delved into this issue very early. Roger Schuler, my friend who blogs at legalschnauzer.blogspot.com. And this case is just so incredible, with a corrupt prosecutor, a corrupt judge, a witness who was coached 60 times to deliver the testimony that ultimately was used to convict Siegelman. And now we have the failure of Obama's Justice Department under Attorney General Eric Holder to advocate properly for justice in this case. Here is an excerpt from my conversation today with Andrew Craig of the Justice Integrity Project.
You know, we're looking for answers here because, right, and we've got to go to something beyond the law books. I attended two of, and actually graduated from two of the top law schools, and I try to, at alumni gatherings or other professional meetings, I try to explain this. And, you know, after two or three things, people are open-mouthed, and then they say, well, this can't really be happening. And then here in Washington, where the main news organizations have never really covered this, they say, well, and then they start looking at me funny, Peter, because, you know, if this hasn't been reported in the Washington Post or the establishment press, then, you know, we must be crazy because we know these, think we know these things.
Well, and I guess we are incredibly naive because we believe in the Constitution. We believe that not only the Justice Department has a name that defines what it's supposed to do, but it has a purpose. And I have been a longtime believer in the system of laws in this country, and I have fought for the rights of individuals who are falsely accused and falsely convicted, and in some cases seen that you're able to actually get justice at the end of some very long days. But this is one of those cases where, from beginning to end, the corruption is so evident. They don't go to much pain to try to conceal it. From Laura Canary, the original U.S. attorney who brought charges against Siegelman, Her husband, Bill Canary, was Karl Rove's business partner for many years.
Could I interrupt just a moment?
Go ahead.
Even as much of an expert as you are, and you've done this nationally famous work on this, this is actually a 13-year prosecution. Mm. And you're overlooking, if I might
go right ahead.
Add, you know, 5 or 6 years of this, of that's such a persecution, such a crusade, that even experts are finding out new dimensions of it. So actually, the prosecution was started in 1999 by a Republican state attorney, or an investigation, and then it became a joint federal-state investigation. Mm-hmm. And then charges were originally filed in 2004 by a first Republican Bush U.S. attorney.
That would have been Alice Martin?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. So you know this. But
you can hear the full interview today at peterbcollins.com. And if you're not a monthly or annual subscriber, we have a new feature, the 24-hour pass, for a single dollar. Yes, $1 gets you into peterbcollins.com, and you can listen to or download as many of our podcasts as you like. And I hope that you will definitely listen to the conversation with Andrew Craig. It is partnered with an interview with Brian Miller, the co-author of a new book called Self-Made Myth, about the wealthy people in this country, some of whom accept their obligation to pay their fair share in taxes. And it's in sharp contrast to the low-tax, less-government millionaires and billionaires who don't care what happens to the rest of the people in this country. Well, a good ruling out of a court here in San Francisco today, as the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals declined to conduct any further review of the overturning of Proposition 8. That was the ballot measure that reimposed a ban on same-sex marriage in this state after the California Supreme Court had found in the Constitution, under the Equal Protection Clause, a right that same-sex couples have to marriage just like straight people do. And this is setting up for a Supreme Court case. I don't expect it to be heard in the session this fall, but it's possible it could go up that fast. And I consider this a real positive step for civil rights and marriage equality in this country. Chad Griffin, the co-founder of the American Foundation for Equal Rights, he's a longtime ally of Rob Reiner, the TV producer and political activist here in California, and he led the charge for this federal challenge, even though many people in the gay community said it was too early and they feared that it would produce a negative outcome that would be hard to change for years, if not decades. And Chad Griffin is quoted as saying that this is yet another federal court victory for loving, committed gay and lesbian couples in California and around the country. The final chapter of the Prop 8 case has now begun. Should the United States Supreme Court decide to review the Ninth Circuit's decision, he's confident that the justices will stand on the side of fairness and equality. And as I've pointed out before, Vaughn Walker, the now retired district court judge, who courageously overturned Prop 8 and also ruled in favor of the only major wiretapping case that has been permitted to go forward, Vaughn Walker wrote the Prop 8 decision with Justice Anthony Kennedy in mind. Many passages he essentially is talking to only one person. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. If the court declines to review it, then Prop 8 is overturned and gays and lesbians can marry in California again. And we'll see how long it takes for all that to play out. It is primary election day here in California, and I want to take this opportunity to share with my listeners what I've been up to since January. I work in my day job. I own a small company, and I work as a media consultant for political candidates whom I personally support. I don't just go out there and work as a hired gun for anybody, but Susan Adams is a candidate who I've worked with for 10 years now. I helped her get elected to the Marin County Board of Supervisors here north of San Francisco, where I live. And she asked me to join her campaign this year. And I have to say it was a tough decision because a good friend of mine, Norman Solomon, who's been on this program many times and has only been absent recently because he's been on the campaign trail, Norman is a candidate in the same race. This is an open seat, which is a rare occurrence for the House of Representatives, and it's a new district redrawn in the 10-year process of redistricting. And this district was not drawn by politicians to choose their voters, but was drawn by an independent citizens redistricting commission. And it's a huge district geographically. It runs from the Golden Gate Bridge all the way to the Oregon border. And as I'm speaking to you, it's about 4 p.m. here on Election Day. And I don't know what the outcome will be. It is too close to call. There is a front runner, Assemblyman Jared Huffman, who is likely to place first. But we have a new primary system in California where the second place finisher, regardless of the party of the first place or second place finisher, will be on the ballot with the first place finisher in the fall. And because this district is predominantly Democratic by registration, it's possible that my candidate, Susan Adams, will play second and be in the general election, a runoff in this case, in November. And that's what we're angling for. And Norman Solomon is very close, as is Susan Adams, to second place. The other contender for second place is a wealthy Silicon Valley businesswoman named Stacey Lawson, who has no political experience, and like Meg Whitman, who tried to buy the governorship, she is starting pretty close to the top and has raised a boatload of money, put $100,000 of her own funds into the race. And it's going to be very interesting to see if voters have been swayed by a slick marketing campaign and a woman who just says jobs, jobs, jobs whenever she opens her mouth. And I don't think that Stacey Lawson is a bad person. I just don't think she'll make a great congresswoman or even a good one. And so it'll be very interesting to see what the total turnout level is and who those voters are and how they decide to vote. And under the new primary system, it's an unknown. If some Republicans will say, gosh, you know, there's no way a Republican will ultimately take this seat, so I'm going to vote for the best, from my point of view, Democrat or the least worst Democrat. So it's going to be very interesting. And let me tell you, when I went to the polls this morning, I'm old-fashioned. Yeah, I'm an old-school guy. I like to go to my precinct and see the ballot and mark it myself. And some people vote by mail. 62% of people in this congressional district are voting absentee by mail. But I prefer to do it the old way. So let me just tell you what I did this morning. And one thing was a surprise to me. Under the new law, and because I'm not registered as a Democrat or a Republican or a Green Party member, I'm what's called declined to state or no party preference, you know, an independent, I was not permitted to vote for Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for president. She's running against Roseanne Barr. And I've interviewed Jill Stein on the program. I think she is solid. I agree with her on the issues. And I wanted to cast my vote for her as a protest against Barack Obama and his widespread violations of my constitutional rights. And when I got to my polling place, they said, I'm sorry, Peter. The way the law is structured, and apparently the way the Green Party elected to participate in this open primary, I was not given an option to take a ballot that would have allowed me to vote for Jill Stein for president. And so when I got into the booth, I was presented with the stark choice of voting for Barack Obama because I took a Democratic ballot, or a write-in candidate. And I checked with my dog, Chloe. She came into the polling place with me. And she and I decided to write in Bill O'Rights. You thought I was going to say Bill O'Reilly? No way. So I am waiting to see the end of all this. If somebody discovers that there was a single write-in vote for Bill O'Rights, because that's what I'm most desperate for in this political process. And I have to say to you that while I participate in elections, both as a voter and as an active supporter, a paid supporter of candidates, a consultant, I had such mixed feelings as I went to the polls this morning. Because on the one hand, there is that sense of personal empowerment, that as an American citizen, I am entitled to a vote. And I know that votes count. My candidate, Susan Adams, in her first election 10 years ago, was not supposed to win. And she won in the primary by a mere 22 votes. And as we've campaigned for Susan Adams over these last 5 months, we've kept that in mind. Every vote counts, and we seek to get as many as we can in order to prevail. At the same time, when I think about the way elections are bought and paid for by corporate interests, how the lapdog media in this country no longer covers our elections in any way that challenges any candidates and really, you know, matters. They don't investigate. They don't evaluate. They act as stenographers. And they'll cover a food fight. They'll cover mudslinging. They'll cover how much campaign cash a candidate has. They'll pay lip service to some of the positions on issues. But they don't help voters get the information they need to make an honest and healthy decision about who is best situated to represent us. And then I think about the stolen elections, not just Florida, not just Ohio, but Wisconsin, where today the recall of Scott Walker is underway. And it's disheartening. And it saps the hope that you feel as a voter who participates in what we think of as a democracy. And I don't have a conclusion about that. I just wanted to share my feelings because, well, I'm guessing that you may have some of those same thoughts as you participate in your own elections. Speaking of that Wisconsin recall, the robocalls were out today, presumably from Republicans and allies of Scott Walker, and they sent misleading messages to voters in Wisconsin saying that if they had signed petitions to recall Scott Walker, their vote in today's election has already been recorded so they don't have to go to the polls. It's bullshit. It's a lie. And it shows what lengths, particularly the corporate-funded Republicans, will go to manipulate the process and try to control the outcome. Meanwhile, the purging of voters in Florida is temporarily on hold. Governor Rick Scott has received a notice from the Federal Justice Department demanding that he end his extensive purge of registered voters. And separately, the registrars, the election supervisors in all 67 counties in Florida, have announced that they will discontinue the state-directed effort to remove names from county voter rolls because they believe the state data is flawed and because of the Justice Department issues. Justice Department said it violates federal voting laws. So that's hopeful, but it's hard to take, and it's not the only place it's happening. Item, Texas, Rick Perry country. 300,000 eligible voters have been targeted in their purge of voter rolls. And Texas does it slightly differently. They send a letter to people basically trying to force them to prove that they are qualified registered voters, even though, hey, they are qualified registered voters. And if people fail to return the form letter, their names are removed from the list. And when you get to the polls, maybe you'll get a provisional ballot, maybe you won't. But it's an ugly surprise that they drop on voters who are most likely to support Democrats. And finally today, the New York Times is attempting to clarify an issue that Republicans want to remain, shall we say, confused or misinformed about. And it has to do with the so-called morning after pill and what it actually does. Because we've seen in this Catholic Church-driven anti-contraception campaign this year that is nominally driven by the implementation of the Obamacare laws, that the right wing has been trying to paint the morning after pill as an instant abortion. And it is not. Never has been. They misconstrue that intentionally in an effort to link birth control with abortion. And the Times says, it turns out that the politically charged debate over morning after pills and abortion, a divisive issue in this election year, is probably rooted in outdated or incorrect scientific guesses about how the pills work. Because they block creation of fertilized eggs, they would not meet abortion opponents' definition of abortion-inducing drugs. In contrast, RU486 is an abortion pill because it destroys implanted embryos and terminates pregnancies. But the morning after pill essentially delays ovulation. And some of these morning after pills thicken cervical mucus so that the sperm delivered by a male have trouble swimming in order to fertilize an egg. And this is the kind of issue where it's so difficult to get people to think rationally and to think with science and facts in mind. The Republican war on science continues, the war on women continues, and they will proceed using misinformation and things that are flatly wrong because it suits their intention. Hey, thanks for listening to today's news and comment. This podcast is FREE, so spread it far and wide. And thank you.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until